Hello, Bulls fans, and welcome to another episode of the Bulls HQ podcast. Before we rip into this podcast, just a quick note on the availability of this show now on iTunes. So you'll be able to get the Bulls HQ podcast through your iTunes players. So hopefully that makes it a little easier to digest this content. So I'll be looking to do something similar with an Android player. So be stay on the lookout for that. I'll update you on that once that is sorted. But yes, a good update for those that have an Apple iPhone and prefer to listen to their podcast via their phone. Today's episode is pretty much a breakdown of the Bulls' upcoming playoff series against the Boston Celtics. And to go through all that with me today, I've got my old friend Kevin Ferrigan to join me to dissect this series. And we're going to have a pretty in-depth look at the series. So hope you enjoy this episode. And hopefully the Bulls are able to actually take a few games off the Celtics. So let's get straight into it. Kevin, how you doing, mate?
Good. How are you?
Good, mate. It's been a while since we've actually chatted and podcast together.
Yeah, it has been over a year for sure. Almost 2 years, basically.
Yeah, that's
year and a half.
I was trying to look up before when the last time we recorded was. And for those that aren't aware, Kevin and I, well, we pretty much started up along with Morton the Dennis Podman podcast. But you didn't hang around for too long because you got a job with the Mavs and. I think it was like the third episode is when you sort of clocked off. And I don't think we've talked since then. So it's good to be speaking to you, man.
Yeah, I mean, we just talk on Twitter.
Yes.
But it is good.
Not
to
in person.
It is good to actually hear your voice and not just hear it through my headphones as I listen to one of the podcast episodes that you've appeared on and or hosted since then.
Yeah, exactly. So, good to be speaking. You weren't speaking to you, and I'm obviously speaking because the Bulls have made the playoffs. It pretty much took them the last day of the season to actually get in, but they've done it now, and they've slid into the eighth seed, and they've pretty much fallen into probably their most favorable potential matchup that they could have had in playing the Boston Celtics. So, the Celtics obviously finished as the first seeds, and the Bulls as the eighth seed. So it's probably the best outcome for the Bulls in terms of matchups. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think so. Their other option was the Cavs, and LeBron murders them every time that they play in the playoffs. the Bulls seem to always rise to the occasion against LeBron in the regular season, and or LeBron just doesn't care about the regular season, one or the other, and then come playoff time, he just raises his game, and the Bulls don't have the ability to do that typically. So, good to avoid LeBron. And I think, honestly, I think that the Celtics are one of the weakest one seeds we've seen in quite a long time in terms of, like, if you just look at their talent, they've, overachieved to a significant degree to be the one seed, in my opinion.
Yeah, and that sort of leads me to my first real question, and that's, I guess, is how credible are the Celtics as a first seed? I don't really know how to process that question, and I'm seeing varying positions. The Celtics, basically since Jan 1, no other team not named Golden State or San Antonio have more wins than Boston since Jan 1. They're a top 10 offense and defense since January 1, so the 7th in offense and 8th in defense. So The general themes of the team are pretty good, but in terms of the East and its competition, it's been pretty weak. So, and to your point, the Celtics are a weak number one, but in processing how credible the Celtics are, where do you sit on that?
Yeah, so there's a few things going on. So I don't necessarily like to just look at the, since the start of the 2017 numbers, just because, especially with the team like the Celtics, where I don't think that they've had like a significant change in their team composition from January 1. So like it's one thing to look at splits like that if there's been a big change. So like I wrote an article for my newsletter this past week, and I wrote about the Raptors and their chances to maybe knock off the Cavs in the playoffs, and I looked at those kinds of splits since the trade deadline, but like that made more sense to me because the Raptors made two big moves. They traded for PJ Tucker and they traded for Serge Ibaka, so that fundamentally altered the composition of their team. So I thought that looking at those shifts made sense. For the Celtics, they've been kind of the same team, I think, right along. So I think looking at the larger sample of the whole season gives you as much information as you want. I think it's, you know, good for them that they're playing better. And I think that there's some degree of that is probably because they are so reliant on systems to be successful, because they don't have the overwhelming talent, that getting those systems in place and getting them, you know, really firing in all cylinders is kind of like probably why they've been so good since January 1. I think that your cutoff points can make a pretty big difference. Because so for like, for instance, I looked at the Bulls and the Celtics since the trade deadline, and the Bulls actually somehow have a better point differential net rating than the Celtics since the trade deadline, which doesn't make any sense to me. but the Celtics have more wins. The Bulls have been like 13 and 12 since the trade deadline, and Celtics have been like 15 and 9. But in terms of net rating, the Bulls have been slightly better. So I think, though, just in terms of the Celtics quality, I think we kind of know what they are. I think one of the things with them is that they maxed out their potential. So I think that they are a team primarily of role players. And, you know, they got Al Horford this season, and I think people thought that that was, you know, going to change their identity to some extent, because last year they were like this overachieving team of role players. I think Al Horford is really, you know, kind of like a souped up role player in a lot of ways. I've thought that he's a good player, don't get me wrong, but I think he's been kind of overrated for a while now, and he's also 30. And I think he does a lot of things pretty well, but I don't think he's really great at anything. And so those guys are valuable, but I don't know that, you know, they're max contract valuable. And so he hasn't really fundamentally changed their identity. And so they're a team of essentially, you know, very, very solid and very well, well-fitting role players. And then they're obviously spearheaded by Isaiah Thomas. And I just don't think, if you look at that roster, that they make sense as a one seed. The East has been very down. The Cavs have not been very good. The Cavs, I think, are still clearly the best team in the East. And I think even the Raptors, if Kyle Lowry had not gotten hurt, would have finished with a better record than the Celtics. So, you know, I do think they're a very weak one seed, and I don't know if they have, you know, another gear to go up during the playoffs. And I think it's worrisome for them that they don't have the best player in the series. Obviously, that's Jimmy Butler. You know, I'm sorry to any Celtics fans that might for some reason be listening. Isaiah Thomas is not better than Jimmy Butler. It's not really close.
No. No way.
Yeah, I don't buy them really that much as a strong team. And I think the Bulls have as good a chance as a 8 seed could probably have. The Bulls have their own issues, which is why I don't think they'll win the series, but they do have the best player in the series. And you know, the Celtics are I wonder about them in terms of, you know, the Bulls had this a little bit when they were the one seed, when Derrick Rose and was still a thing. And they had Tibbs, like they had, there was always this talk that they didn't have an extra gear because they went really hard in the regular season. And so you already had seen what their potential was. I think the Celtics team is like that, except for not quite as good as those Bulls were. So, you know, kind of similar issues. They're maxed out their potential in the regular season. And I don't think that you can't play any more intense, than Marcus Smart already plays, you know? So like,
yeah.
I don't know whether there's any more room for growth for them beyond, you know, the very solid team that they've been.
Yeah, I mean, that's a fair point. And I guess I'm sort of torn on the Celtics. What I would say is I do view them as the most favorable matchup to the Bulls, or for the Bulls rather, despite all, you know, whatever splits you want to take, whether it's Jan 1, after the trade deadline, start of the year, whatever it is, I think you can find an argument for the Celtics being a very good team. But fundamentally, they're a team that over rely heavily on a 5'9" guard who is having an incredible season, but they don't really have much offensive creation outside of Isaiah Thomas. So I can't really get past that point, I guess. Whereas if you where you think about Toronto, they have Lowry, they have DeRozan who can create shots. Obviously, the Cavs have Irving and LeBron on the perimeter, and even the Wizards now, they've got John Wall and Bradley Beal. So whilst other teams have multiple creators, I'm not so sure about the Celtics. So that's probably the biggest fundamental difference between them and their other top seeds in the Eastern Conference. And it's why the Bulls have a very remote chance of beating the Celtics, but there is a chance. So let's get stuck into how the Bulls can actually stop the Celtics and on offense. And that primarily, I guess, rests on actually stopping Isaiah Thomas. How would you actually go about guarding Thomas? He's had an unbelievable season. I think Kevin Durant is pretty much the only more efficient player on a usage percentage greater than 25%. So he's been absolutely incredible for a guy that has such a size disadvantage. But how should the Bulls go about tactically trying to stopping him in this series?
Yeah, so I think, you know, there are two general strategies you could deploy, right? So there's the make other guys beat you idea. So you kind of try to take the ball out of Thomas's hands and force the Celtics to make their other guys swing the ball until they find an open shot and beat you that way. And there's something to that because, as you mentioned, they don't necessarily have a lot of guys who can create offense for themselves or others. What they do have, though, is a lot of guys who can make, you know, a play off the bounce if they're set up in a good scenario. So if you're double teaming Isaiah Thomas in order to take the ball out of his hands, you know, much like the Cavs did years ago with Derrick Rose, they would try to get the ball out of Rose's hands because the Bulls had so many limited players around him. The Celtics players are limited, but they have a little bit more of an ability to catch the ball, make a couple dribbles, and then swing it around to the next guy and keep the defense sort of scrambled and on their heels, essentially. So they can then like attack closeouts and attack guys that are scrambling back into position after sort of helping and recovering. I think that's the danger of trying to get the ball out of Isaiah Thomas's hands. And the other thing is that they're going to swing it and they're going to look for the best shots because they're a very well coached team. And that's largely what they've done outside of Thomas as an offense. I mean, he's carried a huge load for them just in terms of scoring, but, when he's not the one getting shots, it's typically, that's what they do is like teams will try to get the ball out of Isaiah's hands. And then, you know, that's how they kind of, pass, and then get the open shot. Honestly, the real way to take him out of his game is not necessarily what you do to him when he's on offense, but it's what you do to him when he's on defense. So I would be involving him in ball screens and having his man, because they're going to try to stick him on whoever the worst offensive player is for the Bulls in the backcourt, probably. And so I would have his man be the screener in pick and rolls for Jimmy and just have him get run through screens all day and basically try to wear him out and, force switches where he's got to guard Jimmy and let Jimmy post him up. Basically just run him ragged defensively and really try to take his legs out by just wearing him out. And I think, and then you put, the Bulls' other problem is that they don't have a lot of strong perimeter defenders, and like to ask Jimmy to carry the offensive load that he's going to need to carry and then go, be the lockdown defender on Isaiah Thomas. He might be able to do it because he's going to have days off in between. And he's a crazy person. He might say, I want that challenge and I'll go do it. Or it might be the case that they save that. They don't do it all for most of the game, but if it's close down the stretch, then they say, okay, Jimmy, you go guard him and then, you know, also be our offense on the other end. I think that might be the move, but I think for me, the strategy would be try to take his legs out when he's on defense, and then so that when he when you stick to the Celtics shooters and don't help off of them really that much, he's not going to necessarily have his legs will be a little bit sapped. And I also just think that the intensity of playoff basketball, guys are going to be playing just that little bit harder on defense. And so I think that there's a certain extent to which his limitations, you know, of being 5'9", and those things have shown up. If you go and look at his efficiency for his last two seasons in the playoffs for the Celtics, he has not been the same guy in from an efficiency perspective come playoff time. And, you know, I think that's largely because teams are on him tighter. And I think that that's a real, I think that even though, you know, it's a 10 game sample size of playoff games that he's got so far, I think that there is something to that. And I think that, you know, a lot of it is just going to be relying on the Bulls to be sort of intense defensively.
Yeah. Look, everything you touched on there, I would agree with. And I pretty much wrote as much today that, in terms of how I would stop Isaiah, it's not on defense at all. It's by running him through all those sorts of screens that you mentioned on offense when the Bulls are on offense, because yeah, tiring him physically, I think, is probably the best option rather than trying to check him somehow on defense. I'm not really keen on this trapping idea that is sort of being floated. And you mentioned that the Heat did it to Derrick Rose in 2011, and that potentially the Bulls should be trying to do that against Thomas now. But I worry about doing that because the Bulls are not a good team in help defense. When they start doubling and switching and these sorts of things, their communication really goes down the toilet and no one really helps each other. And given that the Celtics are third in three-point makes and attempts this season, I just see a lot of open threes in those scenarios where the Bulls are really trapping Thomas hard, doubling him up. And like you said, the Celtics are a really good passing team, and they will find that open man, and that open man will often be Jay Crowder in the corner or Kelly Olynyk in the top shooting an open three or something like that. So I think everything you touched on there makes complete sense to me. It'll be interesting to see how long Butler actually spends on Thomas, whether it's, you know, periods in the second quarter we see Butler checking him, or if Hoiberg waits to use him purely in the last couple of minutes in the game. That'll be, I think, an interesting component to this series. But I think another thing that the Bulls need to consider as well is, and it's just not necessarily guarding Isaiah, but how do the Bulls actually combat the Celtics' smaller units? So that's going to be a problem as well. So Thomas is obviously a dynamic offensive player, but what Brad Stevens likes to do as well is to have three guards on the floor as well. So if the Bulls do try to trap, it's not like back in 2011 when the Bulls had Kyle Korver and Lol Deng on the wings. The Celtics will have guys like Avery Bradley, Marcus Smart, these guys who can make a play like you mentioned. So how do the Bulls actually go about combating the Celtics' smaller units when the Bulls traditionally like to play with two bigs most of the times?
Yeah, I think the Bulls' biggest obstacle, honestly, is going to be Fred Hoiberg's stubbornness and lack of creativity when it comes to lineups. You know, the fact that as soon as Rondo came back against the Nets last night, it didn't matter because the Nets sat all of their players of any consequence. But like, he brought Rondo back and played him with the other two alphas. And like, we've seen over and over and over again that those three guys together just don't work. If you put two of them out there, any two of them, as long as Jimmy is one of those two. So any combination of Jimmy and Rondo or Jimmy and Wade works, as long as Wade or Rondo is not also out there. Yep. So you can do it, but again, and you also have to have a floor spacer from the big spot. So you probably have to have Mirotić out there. But I think that the biggest issue for them is going to be the fact that Hoiberg is not very creative with his lineups. He doesn't seem to understand matchups that well. He doesn't seem to understand how his players fit together that well. Either that, or I don't know if it's a lack of understanding or if it's cowardice, because he's afraid to put, you know, one of his veterans on the bench because they don't fit necessarily as well with some of the other guys. But it's just an inefficient use of resources. You know, the bench units need shot creators to get the guys that aren't good shot creators open looks. And so to have all three of your shot creators all on the floor all at once, and they're actually making life more difficult for each other, it just doesn't make any sense. And so, like, that's the offensive side of it. And I worry that he's also not creative enough on the defensive side. So, like, I don't think that it's going to make a lot of sense to play two traditional big men at all this entire series, and really probably not at all in the playoffs. If by some weird, miraculous Jimmy Butler goes bananas for four games scenario where the Bulls win the series, it's not going to make sense to play two traditional big men in the playoffs, really. And so, but I suspect that he probably will do that some. But like, I think if you're going to have that small lineup, like, I think, you know, if you had maybe Jerry and Grant, Jimmy Butler, Wade, and so you're playing Jimmy Butler at small forward, but still running the offense through him, play Zipser at the four and Mirotić at the five. Like, that's a lineup that I have wanted to see, just because I, you know, it has shooting, it has guys that can, you know, Zipser's probably not going to be a good defensive player at the four, but like, he's also not the fastest guy anyway. So I think just seeing his floor spacing at the four spot and you know, I don't think he's going to absolutely kill you. He probably wouldn't do that well on the glass, but like, the Celtics are a bad defense, a bad rebounding team anyway. So that doesn't mm-hmm. really matter as much. So like, I don't know. I think that's the lineup that I would like to see him try, but I just don't trust him to be sort of creative or innovative or to have the guts really to try something different like that.
Yeah, look, and I would agree with that. And we sort of saw in the last Nets game what the nine-man rotation was sort of shaping up to be. So obviously Mirotić and Lopez will be the front court starters, and Portis and Felicio look to be the backups, with Zipser and Grant being the main perimeter guys coming off the bench. So that'll be the nine-man rotation heading into the playoffs. Whether Fred Hoiberg has the ability to adjust to that, I would imagine his biggest adjustment will probably be playing a guy like Carter Williams for defensive purposes. I'm sure the Bulls will do that at some point, trying to overcome Isaiah Thomas with length, and I'm sure Fred will reach out to Carter Williams to do that, which I don't really want to see, but for its effects that it will have on offense. But I totally agree with you on that lineup. That would be a really good lineup to combat those smaller units, and particularly because of the Celtics not necessarily being a good rebounding team, you don't really lose anything by putting Mirotić at center. Al Horford isn't going to crush you on the rebounds, and a lot of the times he's playing out on the perimeter anyway. And when the Celtics do go small, they'll have Jay Crowder playing power forward, so you can have Paul Zipser matching up against Crowder. So I don't necessarily see that as a problem as well. So I'm kind of into that unit that you mentioned there, but it'll just come down to whether Hoiberg actually has the ability to implement such a lineup, and I'm not sure if he's going to do so, because at the moment he's starting both Rondo and Wade, and that's a pretty good way to have some defensive flaws straight away in the series. So I'm expecting the Bulls to have some problems with both Avery Bradley and Isaiah Thomas pretty much as soon as the game starts.
Yeah, the Bulls defense at the point of attack is going to be a problem for them all series, because you know, I mentioned playing Jerry and Grant, but he's not really a good defensive player, and probably their best point guard defender is, I guess, Michael Carter Williams, but he has all the problems that Rondo has in terms of, you know, not being a good shooter. And honestly, Rondo is a much better shooter than Michael Carter Williams at this point. Rondo mm-hmm. is actually shot fairly decently on, you know, limited volume, obviously, but he's been able to make some, whereas Michael Carter Williams will put one up and like hit the side of the backboard and not even come close. So you know, I think that there is a little bit of like trying to make square pegs fit in round holes. That is a difficulty that Hoiberg has. Another lineup I was thinking about, you know, if you're not necessarily trying to go against the Celtics' strength, which is their ability to play small, you know, you might try to go the other way and say, all right, well, if you're going to go small, we're going to take advantage of that because you guys are a bad rebounding team anyway, and so we're just going to pound you on the glass. Like, so if they had Butler basically playing point guard, Wade at shooting guard, Zipser at the small forward, and Mirotić at the four, and then Lopez at the five. Like, that's a lineup that still fits together because you still have probably enough shooting between Zipser and Mirotić, and you still have a traditional center who can, you know, Lopez is a good rebounder. Even that is like a lineup that kind of makes sense. You just can't play the three alphas together. Like, you know, that's the biggest thing, because you have the lack of floor spacing on one end. And then, you know, frankly, Rondo and Wade are not good defensive players anymore. And so, you know, to put both of them out there, you're hurting yourself on both ends. You can live with, you know, having one of them out there at a time, but both of them is just, it doesn't work.
Yeah, totally. And I've been pushing this idea that Wade should be coming off the bench, particularly given his injury, and he only have really three games to trying to get himself back into game conditioning. And he did look fairly rusty in those three games. And I don't think there was much for him to, or much for us to learn about Wade in those three games, given that the Bulls were playing some pretty poor opposition. So I've been pushing this theory that he should be coming off the bench and Rondo and Butler should be the starters in terms of alphas, with Paul Zipser starting. I understand that Zipser isn't as accomplished or is just not as good as Dwayne Wade at the moment, but I just think that balance, which you sort of mentioned before, makes sense to me. Would you agree with that logic?
Yeah, I mean, I for me, it really, like, I'm almost completely indifferent to you know, Wade versus Rondo. It just can't be both. Like, you know, I see the logic for having Wade be the one that comes off the bench, especially with the injury, having been out for longer. I know Rondo just had an injury of his own, but he wasn't like out long enough to like get out of shape. Wade has been, you know, has had some time away. And I think, like, honestly, Dwayne Wade against second units is like, it's very strong parallel to Pau Gasol. Like, Pau Gasol, he's, you know, old, but he's still good enough to dominate second units. And like, you know, I wrote a while ago when I was writing for Bloggable that I thought that signing Pau Gasol was a mistake. And it wasn't necessarily just because Pau Gasol was bad. It was because the Bulls were afraid to use him the way that he ought to be used. He goes to San Antonio and Pop says, you're coming off the bench. And like, lo and behold, he looks great because, like, and I know he got a lot of points and stuff for the Bulls when he was here, but like, he was bad on defense and he hurt the Bulls a lot in their starting unit. And whereas like second unit offensive players are not going to hurt him as much on defense because they're just not as talented. And like, there's a lot to be said for Wade in a similar role. Obviously, like, you know, small guy versus big guy, but you know, you need shot creation. You need somebody that a scoring punch off the bench a lot of the time. And you know, that was always the logic, I think, for the Spurs with Manu, was, you know, we need somebody that's going to be able to sop up minutes on the second unit and keep those units afloat so that we don't, you know, fall apart. And it's a better use of our resources to have you with the second unit for chunks of the game and then close with the starters. And I think like something like that for Wade is probably warranted. And, you know, if you want to close with Wade and put Rondo on the bench in crunch time because of the free throw shooting stuff, you know, that makes sense too. I just, you know, I definitely agree that there's a lot of logic there to, and like, I think you can even, like, if you're worried about selling it to Wade, say, listen, like, you're still clearly not in shape. Come off the bench and play your way back into shape and dominate these second units, and your numbers are going to look great for the playoffs. It's not going to hurt your legacy or something to be, you know, super six man or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. And it looked, as I said, that makes sense to me. But going back to what we were mentioning about Hoiberg, it's very clear that he's going the three alpha route. with Mirotić and Lopez, despite that lineup only playing 35 minutes all season. So that in itself will be a story for the Bulls trying to work out on the fly whether that rotation or that starting unit can actually gel together. I would imagine it's going to have troubles, given that, you know, what we've seen from the three alphas already this season. But we'll see how it goes. So we've sort of talked about how the Bulls can go about stopping the Celtics, but how about the Bulls on offense? So you mentioned before that the Bulls will have the best player in this series, and I think most would agree with that, that Jimmy Butler is the best player in this series, but he's going to have a pretty big load offensively as well as defensively. So how much do the Bulls actually have to run things through Jimmy Butler? He actually doesn't lead the team in usage percentage, which is kind of crazy. Dwayne Wade does, but that needs to change in the postseason, I would imagine.
Yeah, I mean, this gets right back to what we were just talking about. I think the fact that Jimmy kind of defers to Wade a little bit, in the sense that, like, that's why their usages are flip-flop from what they ought to be. I think that's a real issue, and that's another reason for, you know, potentially separating them and putting them on separate units, so that you're, you know, when Jimmy's on the floor, he's the one with the ball. And so I think that, you know, it's difficult to talk about this stuff to some extent, because it's like talking about what we end up talking about what the Bulls ought to do. And then, like, there's always, like, in the back of my mind, or, you know, it's not even really the back of my mind, it's kind of front of mind right now, is just the likelihood of what they're going to do versus what they really ought to do. And, you know, I think that Jimmy's going to have a difficult time because Hoiberg looks like he's going to be going with the three alphas in the starting lineup. Jimmy looks great when you give him a minimum of two shooters around him. I wrote about that earlier in the season. That trend is held, goes back, you know, beyond. It goes all the way back to last year. Whenever he had two shooters on the floor, he looked phenomenal. And when he has just one or zero shooters on the floor with him, you know, his numbers suffer, and the team suffers. And so he's going to be playing, you know, essentially in a straitjacket. He's not going to have a lot of spacing unless Hoiberg smartens up. And you know, my faith in that happening is pretty low. So, you know, it's possible that Isaiah Thomas might look better than him at the end of the series or have better numbers, simply because his coach didn't do the most obviously prudent thing and give him some shooting around him because he was afraid to, you know, make Rajon Rondo or Dwayne Wade angry at him. And so I don't know. I think Jimmy will still have a good series just because he's that good, but his efficiency could suffer from the fact that he's going to be getting swarmed a lot, I would imagine. And you know, frankly, the Celtics have a lot of very good perimeter defenders. Marcus Smart is one of the best perimeter defenders in the league. You know, Jay Crowder's a solid perimeter defender, and he and Jimmy Butler don't get along for whatever reason. I think Jay Crowder has some kind of problem with him because Jay Crowder is, like, the most petty human being alive. And Avery Bradley is, like, an annoying perimeter defender. I don't think Avery Bradley is nearly as good as his reputation as a defender. He does that stuff that, like, looks really effective, in terms of, like, he does a lot of the things that are very showy on defense. Like, he's, like, you know, he'll press up on guys full court and, you know, but it doesn't ever really seem to, not ever, but a lot of the times it doesn't really seem to do much. It just, like, makes a guy annoyed with him. But in terms of actual, like, stopping guys from scoring or whatever, I think he's a little bit overrated there. Don't get me wrong, he's a solid defender, but I don't think he's, like, this all NBA defender that a lot of people seem to think, and especially Celtics fans. I had an argument with my buddy who is a diehard Celtics fan about this, and he was, like, trying to tell me that Avery Bradley was, you know, this very good defensive player, and I was just like, I don't know, like, after, you know, as many years as he's been in the league with this reputation, I think it would show up somewhere in the data. And, like, if you look at every single year of, like, all the adjusted plus minus statistics, he always rates out as, like, a perfectly average defender. So with that many seasons of data, I start to say, all right, well, maybe there's something wrong with people's eye test, you know. But anyway, he's still like a capable defender. He's definitely not hurting anybody out there. So they have a lot of bodies to throw at Jimmy Butler, and he doesn't have a ton of help. And the help that he really needs is floor spacers to give him driving lanes and give him targets to make passes to. And unfortunately, it looks like Fred Hoiberg is not going to give him the tools he needs to. He's not going to let him be great. It looks like the Celtics' best defense is Fred Hoiberg, basically.
Oh, man. Well, I mean, that's a separate topic in itself. But you alluded to my next point there, which was going to be the amount of options that Celtics really do have to put on Jimmy Butler, whether they're actively trying to do it or whether it just comes in switching scenarios. You mentioned Jay Crowder, Avery Bradley, Marcus Smart, even Jaylen Brown. If he gets minutes, he probably won't play too much, but he could have a go at Jimmy Butler. So they've got four guys at least that could swing onto Jimmy Butler at some points, and just that ability to have a fresh body on Butler at times, I think, could be a problem. That does worry me, particularly that the Bulls don't have a lot of consistent offensive options next to Butler, as you alluded to. So, and I guess one of those inconsistent types of players that we do have on offense is Nikola Mirotic. Maybe a difficult question to answer, but it's a very easy question for me to ask. What Nikola Mirotic is actually going to show up in the playoffs? Do we even know? Is it possible to know?
I think, like, so one of the things that I think frustrates me about how people talk about Mirotic is that the one thing he's really inconsistent with is his jump shot. Yeah. I think he's actually a very consistent player in terms of some of the other stuff. Like, I think he's always a capable defender. You know, he has people have given this reputation because he's like kind of a wiry, skinny European guy that he's this bad defender but he's actually pretty strong for how he looks. And he tends to do very well at keeping guards in front of him for the most part, unless you're talking about like the very fastest guards in the league, and you know, like most guys can't stay in front of those guys. But like for a big man, he does pretty well on switches. He gets a lot of steals, especially for a power forward. He is a solid defensive rebounder. Like he does like almost everything well on defense. He's always like a pretty good facilitator if you give him the ball and like say go make a play. So like he can run pick and rolls and not be a disaster there. Really, the thing that's most inconsistent about him is his jumper. And I think that's honestly, like, some of that is, you know, he's a hot and cold shooter. I wouldn't say that's a complete, like, misnomer. But I do think that some of it is just, like, small sample size. Like, he doesn't take that many shots, typically. So if he's and like the other thing that happens with him is that if he's having a night that where he feels like he's off, he'll stop shooting, and or like get down on himself or whatever. And I think he gets in his own head a little bit, whereas he should be just like saying, no, I'm like a 36%, 37% 3-point shooter, and sometimes I'm gonna miss some in a row and just keep firing, shoot or shoot, you know, like that whole thing. And so I think people look at him and like think, the only value he brings is that he's a shooter. And so if he's not shooting well, then he's playing inconsistently. And I think that he brings a lot of additional value. I'm, you know, a big Mirotic guy, or Mirotic. I'm a big, you know, fan of his. And I think, you know, it's the Bulls seem to be a little bit down on him. And I'm going to be very annoyed if they let him go in free agency without, you know, really making an effort to keep him. I think he's a restricted free agent, so, you know, I think they should probably match whatever offer he's likely to get, because I think he's still relatively young, and I think he is a two-way player, and they don't have enough of those. I think he helps offensively because of the floor spacing, and because he does have playmaking ability, and I think he does so many things well on defense. Besides, like, he's not obviously a good post defender, but like post defense doesn't really matter in the modern NBA. I mean, it matters a little bit, but not really. And so like I think he'll be a positive player for them regardless. Whether his shooting will be consistent, That I don't know, but he's valuable to me regardless of whether he's making shots. Obviously, I hope he's making shots because I really don't want to hear Bulls fans complain about him if he has a cold snap against the Celtics. And especially because the Bulls their Bulls front office is kind of like dumb enough to like hold that against him and like be like, all right, we don't need him if he has like a bad or at the very least to like cynically use that against him when they're like kicking him as he goes out of town after he signs with some other team and they're like decide not to match it and they'll like run his name through the mud in the media or whatever.
I wonder how many people are cringing at all this Mirotić talk, but because he is one of the. I guess, or probably is the most polarizing Bull at the moment. But like you, I am a Mirotić homer, so I am hoping for a big series from him. One, to justify, I guess, the inconsistent year he has had, him finishing strongly to the season. Will obviously be very good for him in terms of contract negotiations, but it'll be obviously favorable for the Bulls, not only this season, but potentially looking forward as well. And what I've noticed with Mirotić as well is he's found a good relationship with Jimmy Butler in their two-man game. I think there's something to work with in this series as well as moving forward. I think those two have a connection. But to your point, I think this is probably the best series for Mirotić to show out in terms of his defense. The Celtics don't have a lot of front court bruises that are going to hurt him in the post. And like you alluded to, he's very good on switches and he can stay in front of guards. And unless it's on Isaiah Thomas, who's going to blow past pretty much everyone in the league, in switches, I'd be comfortable with Mirotić switching on to Marcus Smart or Avery Bradley or Terry Rozier or whoever it is. He can contain those guys in pick and roll. So this could actually be a good series to highlight Mirotić's defense ability and hopefully for the final time, kill any narrative off that he is a poor defender. But I guess my biggest worry with Mirotić is the fact that the Bulls are going down this 3-alpha route. So every time we've seen Mirotić succeed at the NBA level, it's when he's been featured more as a playmaker or someone that's able to make decisions for himself with the ball in hand rather than being a guy that finishes a play on a jump shot. So you alluded to his jump shooting and how it can be hot and cold. And I think it just comes down to role and confidence that when he's sort of relegated to that jump shooting role, he gets down on himself because that's effectively what he's out there to do. And if he starts missing, he goes into his shell. He'll only take about 6 to 7 shots and they'll be bad shots, but he can't fight his way through that. So I'm a bit worried that not only is the 3-alpha effect going to be counterintuitive to those three guys themselves, but also for a guy like Mirotić, who's a better player when he actively has the ball in his hands. So I think that is something to watch out for the Bulls. And given that, and I sort of alluded to the guys, Rondo and Wade, they were brought here to be, I guess, the guys that pushed the Bulls back into the playoffs after obviously missing last season. What are you expecting from these two guys? How effective do you think each will be? And between the two, who has a greater likelihood of actually being a bit of a disappointment?
Well, I think the expectations are higher for Wade because yeah. He did play really well in the playoffs last year. And he's also historically been the better of the two. You know, he's maybe the third or fourth best shooting guard of all time, depending on who you ask and you know how much people value longevity and versus peak performance. But he has a greater likelihood of disappointing, I would say, because he's not in shape right now, because his expectations are probably the highest. And you know that some of that is because he's Dwayne Wade and some of it is just because I think he you know, has been the better player of the two this season, even though Rondo has finished this season probably stronger than Wade did. But I just think that the people are going to expect a lot more from Wade than from Rondo. Rondo's reputation around the league and just even among fans, I think, is pretty. The baseline is established pretty low. There are still some like hardcore Rondo stans out there. Every once in a while, one of them will yell at me because I tend to be a Rondo hater. So I think most likely to disappoint is probably Wade, just because of the expectation level. I don't necessarily expect either of them to be super effective. People have talked about playoff Rondo and whether that's going to be a thing. I don't know. The Mavericks, the last time he was in the playoffs, Rondo got sent home by the Mavericks. So I don't know if playoff Rondo is still a thing. I don't know if that's even something that's still in there for him. But maybe he'll have that. But I think, again, I don't mean to belabor the point, but I don't think that they're coach is putting them in the best scenario to succeed. So I think both of them are going to be less effective than they might be if Hoiberg knew what he was doing. I think that's probably the where I'd come down on it. Is like, I don't expect them to be super effective. And I largely attribute to that to the fact that, like, well, one, they're not, both of them are not very good anymore. They're like, okay. And then the other aspect being that they're not going to be put in the best situations for them to flourish. And, you know, that's too bad, because it would be better if they were. We'd get a better, more entertaining series. And, you know, the Bulls would probably still lose, but, it would make the series better. And, those guys would look better and it'd be more entertaining.
Yeah, definitely. And we discussed before the option of putting Wade on the bench, or having him come off the bench rather. And one of the reasons I actually like that logic is the fact that the Bulls have a kind of a weak bench at the moment. So their bench actually has zero games of playoff experience. There isn't any shot creation at all on that bench unit. And I'm fearful that that may be the greatest divide between the teams heading into the series, the difference in depth and bench play. So would you agree that that is the biggest difference between the two teams?
Oh, absolutely. The Celtics' depth is one of their great strengths. Arguably their greatest strength, because they're not a team, as I mentioned sort of at the outset of all this, that they're not a team with a tremendous amount of, high-end talent. They're a team of, depth and a lot of quality role players, maximizing themselves within a role. And their bench is much better than the Bulls bench. The Bulls have one of the weakest benches, in the league probably. The Bulls team overall is probably one of the weakest outside of Jimmy Butler. Like, I think, it was Nathan Walker from Nylon Calculus tweeted out a thing where he took RPM wins and adjusted it for basically this concept called Morris wins, which is named after Benjamin Morris, who's a 538 writer. And basically the idea is that, like, we always look at everything through the lens of point differential, but there is additional information in which teams win, because winning is like a repeatable skill. You see that with teams that consistently underperform their win expectation, like the Timberwolves. Like, every year they always disappoint relative to what their point differential is. That's a kind of a long digression, but Benjamin Morris put together this formula that, like, gives you a better predictability of likelihood of winning by combining point differential and win percentage. And so Nathan took that and adjusted real plus minus wins for guys relative to their so the Bulls point differential, I think, is worse than what they actually ended up winning. So Jimmy got a boost in that metric, and he actually came out first in RPM wins when you adjust for that. And he was like worth like 20 wins over a replacement. If you think about it, the Bulls won 21 games. If they didn't have Jimmy Butler and they replaced him with like a guy off the scrap heap, they would have won 20 games. If they had had like an average player, they would have maybe won 25 games or something like that. Like, their team is really bad outside of Jimmy. Whereas the Celtics, their top to bottom is sort of what their strength is. Like, Isaiah Thomas has had a great year, don't get me wrong, but like, if he's your best player, like, you shouldn't be a 53 win team. You just shouldn't. But they have a lot of quality guys around him, which is another reason why, like, the idea that he was an MVP candidate was silly to me, because they have a very good roster.
So it's funny. I just mentioned that maybe the biggest gaps between the two teams is their benches. But thinking about it a bit more, maybe the biggest difference between the two teams is actually coaching. So obviously Brad Stevens is pretty heralded as the Boston Celtics coach, whereas Fred Hoiberg, a lot of people in the preseason had him as their pick for the coach that's most likely to get fired. So two coaches on complete opposite ends of the spectrum, both coaches that have come out of the college system into the NBA. One's obviously been tremendously successful. The other has hovered around 500 and has struggled. Maybe the coaching aspect is the biggest difference between the teams, not necessarily the benches. Obviously, the bench part of it plays into the coaching factor, but maybe the difference between Stevens and Hoiberg is the biggest gap in this series.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, there's a lot of different ways to measure a coach, but there's two things that I think really are illustrative of the differences between Hoiberg and Stevens. So Stevens is consistently really, really good at getting shots out of timeouts. And so that's like, people like love to look at that as like, who's a good coach, because, you know, if that's where a coach can influence, you know, seemingly influence the most, is out of a timeout, because they're drawing up the play, they're calling it. It's basically all coming from them. And like, if they've practiced well enough, then they'll execute well. And if not, then not. So there's like those two aspects of it. And Stevens is always really, really good about out of timeout plays. And Hoiberg is, I mean, Stefan Noe from The Athletic has hit on this over and over and over again. Hoiberg is one of the worst in the league at out of the timeout plays. Just the Bulls consistently get bad shots, or don't even get shots off. Out of those kind of scenarios. And, you know, I don't necessarily put as much weight on the ATO stuff as maybe some other people do, because like, I think that it is a data point and maybe a even really good data point, but like, there's obviously also a lot more to, coaching than just drawing up nice plays out of timeouts. Like, lineup choices mm-hmm. matter a lot. Getting guys to buy in matters a lot. Having the respect of your players. But even on those sort of things, you can see that all of the Celtics really buy into everything that Stevens is selling. And Hoiberg can't even get Jimmy Butler to call a timeout from the floor. Like, Jimmy just tells him no and like says, I'm going to isolate here, and goes and gets a bucket, because he just doesn't trust Hoiberg at all. You know, from a lineup perspective, like, Brad Stevens is very well known for like having statistics people. Like, when he was at Butler, they had a guy that was constantly running numbers on different lineup combinations to find like what's the best lineup. I think he's playing lineups that make more sense together. He's adapting to matchups. He's doing all of those kinds of things. Whereas like Hoiberg, I've hit it like multiple times just in this podcast. Like, the three alphas thing is like a prime example. Last year with Pau Gasol, his inability to get the buy-in or to even have the guts to try to get the buy-in from Gasol to say, hey, like, we need to put you on the bench, and, you know, we're going to bring, Taj or Joe Kim in as starters, or Felicio or whoever. Like, his complete inability or like just lack of trying to do anything like that is just illustrative of the point. So that's like all these different metrics of like what, not even, they're not even like metrics, but like all these different like ways that you could analyze what a coach is and like just look at how they influence players and influence outcomes. And Hoiberg comes up short relative to Stevens and relative, frankly, to most coaches in the NBA, across the board. And, you know, he got ranked by, you know, an ESPN panel as the worst coach in the league. I don't know if he's the worst coach in the league, but I feel pretty comfortable putting him in the bottom five. And, you know, that's not going to be good enough against a coach. And, you know, I think maybe Brad Stevens is a little bit overrated, just because I'd like to see him win a playoff series before people say he's, you know, the next Popovich. But, you know, to have a team that has the talent level that they have win 53 games and be the one seed is still pretty impressive. And so it is a massive mismatch. So those two things, the bench and the coaching, are probably going to be the things that ultimately lead Boston to win the series.
Yeah, I would agree. And if nothing else, well, I think what we've learned here is that you do not like Fred Hoiberg.
I don't even dislike him. I just don't think he's good at his job. Like, I think
That's what I meant. That's what
he seems like a nice enough guy.
Yeah.
I think the okie doke that he tried to pull on Joakim Noah last year was kind of messed up, because he was like, "Oh yeah, it was Joe Kim's idea to come off the bench," and then Joe Kim was like, "To hell it was." No. So that was kind of a slimy move, but like, you know, he seems like a perfectly nice guy. He doesn't strike me as a leader of men. Every time I ever see him on the, I've tweeted about this a bunch of times, but every time you see him in the, in like the sideline interviews, even with like the media people, he looks frazzled. He looks like he doesn't like, I don't know. He just doesn't look confident. I empathize with that a little bit, because a lot of the times I'm more or not confident enough when I'm saying certain things, like in my own like job or whatever, and like don't have the full confidence, because I'm like hedging my bets or like whatever. But like, you're a coach, like that's a huge part of the job, is just having the confidence that you belong there and that like these guys should listen to you. And he never strikes me as really having that, I guess, gravitas, for a lack of a better word.
Yeah. No, I think most would agree with you on that one. So, look, we've gone deep in this series. I think we've pretty much covered the main talking points. So, let's wrap it up with a bit of a prediction. We'll see who comes out right after the series. I'm tipping we're both going to be predicting something similar, but give me your prediction and how the series unfolds.
I think the Celtics win. The question is really, how many games does it take? I'm inclined to say, I think my pick would have been Celtics in six, but after talking about it, I feel like, and thinking about Fred Hoiberg being at the helm, I'm kind of like, maybe it'll be five, but I guess maybe I'll be optimistic for once and say Celtics in six. And just chalk it up to Jimmy Butler's gonna single-handedly win like two games. And that's against the incompetence of his head coach and his team's lack of a bench. He'll just play all the minutes and just drag them to two wins, just like he dragged them to 41 wins when they had no business winning that many games.
Fair call. I could definitely see that scenario playing out. And we should mention that the Bulls, I believe, will have three games on TNT during this series. So
that is another
whether
key
that's
point.
A factor or not, that could be a factor. Maybe that pushes it out to seven games. Who knows? But I'm gonna say Celtics in five. And the reason I'm saying that is it would be typical Bulls to win the first game and for the Celtics to come out flat in the playoffs after coming out or winning the East. And the Bulls to upset them in the first game and then to lose 4-0 from then on. I think that would be typical Bulls in that sense. So that's pretty much what I'm expecting. So you're going Celtics in six. You're being the optimist. I'll be the pessimist and I'll say Celtics in five. So we'll lock that away and we'll see who's closer once the series is done.
We swap shoes. Usually I'm the pessimist and you're the more optimistic voice.
Yeah, between us, generally I'm a pessimist, but between us, yeah, I think you probably are more pessimistic than I usually am. But I'm happy to wear that hat today, so that's all good. But look, I appreciate you joining me. I think we dissected this series pretty well. It'll be interesting to see how it all plays out. But yeah, hopefully the Bulls at least show up and perform admirably. I think that's pretty much all we can ask for at this point. So appreciate you joining me on the show. Where can people follow you on Twitter, on your website, all that sort of stuff?
Yeah, so Twitter is at NBA Couchside. Very, very funny pun. website is nbacouchside.com. And I also have a newsletter that I do. You can sign up for that at patreon.com/nbacouchside. It's $5 a month. I write a newsletter, or basically like an article, where I try to do a statistical deep dive on some thing that interests me from the NBA every single week, and people seem to like them. It's $5 a month, so it's, you know, the cost of maybe a very large coffee. So yeah, if you want to check that out, that's where you can get all things me when it comes to basketball.
Yeah, and further to that point, I subscribe to Kevin's newsletter, and it's really good. You've probably picked up on it from the way Kevin has spoke throughout this podcast, but he's very analytically driven, and a lot of his newsletters and posts will follow that theme. So you will learn a lot of stuff from reading Kevin's work. So if you haven't already and you're listening to this, I would definitely suggest subscribing to Kevin's newsletter. It's not necessarily just Bulls focused, but NBA at large. So he will cover the league, and you do get some good content there. So definitely worth $5, I would say. So thanks again for joining, mate. Really appreciate it. And hopefully Bulls HQ will be back shortly with some game summaries. We'll see how often I can get to that, but hopefully I'll be able to get out some new content, some new podcasts as the games progress. Hopefully the Bulls get a few wins. Check out Bulls HQ for some regular content. Hopefully I'll be able to be covering the game as well from an article perspective, but check out the website and there will be some fresh content up there. So until next time, this has been the Bulls HQ podcast.